Never going to get to the bottom of this.
We are being live streamed now. We figured it out.
We're live-ish.
I'm Tobias Carlisle, joined by Jake Taylor and Bill Brewster. We got the band back together. What's happening?
What up, Munger? I'm back.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
Oh, what a classic. Have to go back and
watch.
Good
to have Billy back in the house.
Nice to be here, gentlemen. Apologies for the state of my office. We are almost in transit, so there's that.
I didn't notice anything different.
It looks cleaner than normal. What's going on?
Noted. Tell you what, recently got prescribed Concerta.
What's that?
Which is an ADHD medication. I will tell you, I think I've been a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest for a while. So we'll see how it goes. I'm sure I will get used to it, and it will taper off here, but for now I feel like Superman.
I hear from a lot of old lawyer friends of mine that there's a lot of ADHD medication that might be used off-label in order to get documents out, get things done, work late.
Doesn't shock me. Back in college, I may have done similar things, though that was with Adderall. This is a little different. Anyway, I digress.
I think that's been going on
long
for
story
a while.
Short, my office has been more organized recently. Fair criticism.
You need to get,
past.
A screen like this, just block the carnage behind, block the chaos. Yeah,
that's probably right.
Let me give a shout out to, what do we got? London first in the house, Sterling, Scotland. What's up? Brandon, Sugarland, Texas, Minneapolis, Oaxaca.
Oaxaca, where the heck is Oaxaca?
Hola a todos de Oaxaca. Everybody in Oaxaca.
Dude, shout out to them.
Back in oil field, Saskatchewan, Seven,
that's what's up.
Lena, Finland, Gulf of Mexico. How you doing? Boise, Kennesaw.
Gulf of Mexico, Kennesaw. How are you doing, by the way?
Yeah, let's get some updates on the
hope
rig.
You're okay.
Glasgow. Toronto, Helsinki, this is a great spread. San Fran, Arlington, Tallahassee, South Dakota, Toronto, Kuopio, Finland, Finnish.
You're just making places up at this point.
I feel like it. Well, I'm not the one making them up, but Finland is representing strong. Australia, wake up early, 3:30 a.m. there. Let's get going. Mexico, Singapore, Mexico City, Liverpool. Hey, Mexico's doing well.
And this is the podcast, folks.
We just read them all out. That's it.
Yeah, Ian Castle's out here just typing away at different places.
What's news, Billy? Have you paid attention to the markets at all for the last summer? Does anybody pay attention to the markets over summer?
I paid attention to the businesses that I own.
Yeah, you're a real investor.
That's your problem.
Right. I don't know, man. My target allocation, generally speaking, like Greenblatt shared this on a podcast and I thought he's smart and this is smart. So I've lived my life by this. And if I'm misattributing it, I think it's smart and it's nice to misattribute it to him. Anyway, he said like pick an asset allocation. And if you think the thing, so I pick 70-30 because that makes some sense to me. And then there's some alternatives in there. But I basically said it's if you think things are like roughly in line with where they could be, don't deviate. If you think things are screamingly cheap, go to 60-40 or 80-20. And if you think things are screamingly rich, go to 60-40. I'm at 70-30 right now. Not terribly comfortably, but that's where I'm at.
So you're at 70-30. So that's your default setting.
Yeah. And I obviously have endowment bias for everything that I own. So I think it's cheaper than the market and I'm going to get crushed.
Yeah. I hate the market, but I love my names.
That's right. Yeah. My names are not correlated. Y'all's maybe, but I am a picker.
I think Graham used to say along a similar line, but I think he said 75, 25, and you should never go below 25 equities and never go above 75 equities. You know, that's
great. I got cash coming in. The other thing is I get cash coming in and like, we've talked about this in the past, but I kind of look at it like, I just don't see assets right now as boy, I am going to make a ton of money just like taking risk. So I'm not like, and plus freaking short-term yields are 5.5% and you can lock in reasonably decent long-term yields. I'm not willing to take like tons of duration, but I'm not in some big hurry to go out and buy equities here. And if it works, it'll work and I'll be fine. What's up?
How far out are you willing to go right now? 2 year?
I don't know. For like the right credit, I'd probably go to 5. But you know, like I think charter. It, I mean, obviously, people can debate whether or not they like it, but a name like that, I think you could take some duration on that.
But, in the debt.
Yeah. I don't know though. I mean, credit spreads are. I'm kind of not certain where credit spreads are, but it would not shock me if that's like a reasonably decent alternative right now. But I wouldn't go outside of that.
For you, JT, you got a new background there.
Yeah, I'm in London at the moment, and
London, England.
An office with some ships on the walls. So that's fun. So,
Florida, California, and London. I mean, it's such an international, such a global podcast.
One of these places has done well with COVID. At least according to a professor in Stanford, but what does he know?
Yeah.
His Stanford professor said Florida, not California.
That's what he said. Clearly, well, probably not. Yeah. I heard you guys get canceled yesterday or last week for you know, these free market talks also. So it's nice to see you all are you know, continuing the tradition that we started.
I'll wear that one.
Yeah.
We survived because like that Austrian, like for one thing, criticism of the Fed, like you've narrowed it down to a tiny little percentage of people who know or care.
Yeah. And no one's listening to this anyway, so it's you can't get canceled.
I'm relying on it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I bet the overlap of Fed critics and our listeners, well, your listeners, is quite good. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Everybody comes here for the Fed criticism.
That's right. And the perfect macro takes also.
Yeah, stays for the 10-3 inversion.
That's right. Buckle up, folks. There'll be more.
1.38 today. Looks like it's been creeping up. It'll get there eventually. I was not going to mention it, but since you brought it up, 1.38. It's a long way from closing. But
I'm surprised we made it 8 minutes into the show before.
When you wake up, do you have, you know how we have the deck clock in the US? Do you have that like in your bedroom, like a ticker?
It's one of the things I check. I check it every day. Not necessarily because I think it's going to work, just because I'm kind of interested to see whether it will or not.
Yeah.
Like, when you were a kid in Australia, did you ever think that, boy, someday when I'm an adult, I can't wait to just wake up every day
and check the 10-3 inversion.
Dude, he was out there on the farm and whatnot, and every day he just couldn't wait till 10 a.m. or 3 p.m., and like there was just always something about 10-3.
He's down there in British Texas. And
British Texas, indeed.
Here's the
wrangling and wrestling.
Here's the thing that people don't realize, that farmers are, you know, incredibly sophisticated about commodity prices and those sort of things, because they have to be, because that's their business. So they know the price of all of the inputs and their outputs, all that sort of stuff. They know that stuff. I used to go to these, you know, it's like a conference, except it's outdoors, and there's all of the farm equipment and stuff lying around, and there are people pitching like how their software can help you increase yield management, the laser lever your land and all that sort of stuff. Like and there's a lot of American, you know, because I think American country and Australian country are much closer together than American city and American country and an Australian city and Australian country, because they're dealing with the same thing. Like they're speaking the same language.
Hold up. Wait. Australian country, American country, same. Yep. American city, Australian city, same.
I don't know so much, but probably closer. I would say the cities are closer psychographically than the country area. So the country areas are closer to each other than the city. You know, sorry.
Oh, okay. We're talking geography.
The location. So if you're in the you're more to talk about with a country person from a different country than you are for a city person in your own country. I know that was complicated, but
no, that makes sense. I get it.
Yeah.
So, like they all know the commodity price. They all know all that stuff that they're getting. Like their computer screens look like, you know, like ticker feeds of commodity prices. They know the interest rates, they know the currencies, they know the commodities.
Are they upside down though? That's what I've always wondered.
I honestly, I was too young. I'd had no idea what was going on. It was very complicated. Do you know the rural, that would be better. Thanks, Johnny.
Yeah, we knew.
A lot, of, A lot of my friends got picked up out of, like, they went to an agricultural college and they got picked up by like a London investment bank to trade, you know, grain or whatever, because they, because they knew those markets really well. If I'd have been smart, that's what I've been doing. Then I wouldn't be running this podcast. I'd be retired somewhere or blown up.
Yeah, I would blow up if I was a trader. That I'm certain of.
A lot of people.
I think a lot
of people blow up.
Yeah, well, so when I was going through this diagnosis that got me this Concerta, she like, you know, we're going through my personality and my brain and whatnot. She was like, you should probably be mindful of the amount of risk that you take because you're like genetically predisposed to be risk seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's very interesting because I've dialed back concentration quite a bit and I sleep a lot better at night. And, you know,
I 23andMe of you for that, or she just made
How did she do that?
I mean, I got, we got pretty forensic on family history and stuff like that. So I guess it was through my own lens. I mean, it's possible I either articulated my family history wrong or she said it. Maybe she interpreted it incorrectly, but either way, she confirmed my bias. So I like what she had to say.
Well, there is a dopamine receptor difference between people. Like, you're just slightly more susceptible to being dopamine seeking. Like, it just feels that much better. And it's the R4 allele that is like this. And what they found, this is so fascinating. So picture a globe, right? And you have, when you look at this certain R4 receptor, it has a higher prevalence as you move down through North America, and it keeps getting more and more concentrated as you get down to South America. So it was basically like novelty seeking people just kept going further and further south after the Aleutian land bridge. And now down in South America, there's this really high concentration of the R4 allele that is the, you know, has a novelty seeking bias to it.
Huh.
Does that work east to west across the US? You see the same thing
down
to
like Malaysia and down into those, down on that side of the planet.
And novelty seeking would maybe be associated with risk seeking, you think?
Yeah.
Interesting. So we should be advertising online gambling down south, the further south we can. That's the capitalist take on that.
Where are you? That's interesting. As little as possible, or is there some like optimized point that's halfway down? Like, it's, I don't know.
Stop in Mexico and you're like, yeah. You're ready to, no, I don't know about that. And these are just proclivities, right? Like, how it gets expressed is your epigenetics, the environment will change what gets turned on and off, right? So it's not, this stuff is not really destiny per se. So I wouldn't get overly prescriptive about it, but it is super fascinating that the genetics led to geographic population differences.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I think, you know, one of the things that I think Buffett has said that you either, like, you can't really learn investing or whatever. It's more like an endowed trait or whatever. I'm not totally saying that right, but I think he's saying like your personality type. I think, I mean, obviously this is self-serving to say this, but I think it's a much more important thing to like kind of know your weaknesses and then structure around those, as opposed to just being like, oh, well, you know, I mean, think about a world where you just say, well, I'm not born for investing, so I'm going to give it to some fucking guy at Raymond James. Like, that guy's a chotch. So, you know,
Raymond James.
Criticized by category.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, I know a lot of these guys. I, you know, I like a lot of them. They're nice guys, but they're salespeople, right? So I can't, like, you know, I'm trying to figure out life here. So anyway, no offense to the good people at Raymond James, but you know, it's kind of an interesting, it's all a learning thing. A lot of the people that I've seen that have made very big mistakes, I think, are people that haven't maybe acknowledged who they actually are, and they like live in some form of denial about it. And I think it costs them a lot. It's just me.
It's good advice in the investment world, especially because I think the stress of markets will eventually reveal where the cracks are eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing like the markets to reveal whatever psychopathology you got lurking in there.
Yeah.
So I'm like 100% an upstart, and it's this great company that's coming. No,
what is that? What do they do there?
It doesn't matter. It's a nice chart. Well, it was a nice chart, and then it got cut in half. So I immediately borrowed on margin because that's how it works. I kid.
Well, that stuff's back. I checked the Morningstar star boxes for the last 12 months, and it's been a big growth 12 months. And as you go less big or less growth, you've done slightly worse. I was kind of surprised. It's quite a bounce back. I guess where the bottom was October last year, so I guess we're kind of coming up on that, which is probably why.
Hmm. Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
You're asking the wrong guy. I've been wrong. I'll tell you what I think, and then you can just fade me, and that's probably
we'll do the opposite.
Just Costanza me. Yeah.
Yeah.
What inning?
Yeah, what inning?
Of the rebubble.
Because I feel like I just did this. I was looking at ARK, the ARKK AUM over the last, just since inception, just to see what it had done. And it's kind of hard to tease anything out, but I looked at year on year, and it's crazy when you look at ARK on a year on year basis. There's this massive AUM gains through to March 2021. So March 2018 was the first kind of run up, then March 2021. And I sent it through to JT yesterday, just jokingly saying, hey, that means like 3 years. The next one is March 2024.
They're due for a big
coming. It's that tsunami, you know, that meme with the dude turning around like, here it comes.
Wait, what do you think that is 2024?
Oh, just the 3 years.
It's saying there's a totally 3 year gap. Yeah. This will be another 3 year gap. And then, you know, it's the locusts are due to come out of the ground.
Yeah.
Every three years.
March seems to be when they come out.
Well, shout out to her for outlasting George Noble.
Wow, that was short-lived.
It was short-lived. No, not that guy. Not that guy. No way. I have you put yourself out there like that, you take retail money and you blow it up. I will criticize by specificity. Same way I go at a Chamath or whatever the hell his name is. I apologize to everyone I offend when I consistently mispronounce it, but I will refer to him as Skinny Legs from now on, and that's something we can all understand. Or Chochmoth.
Kathy's done well. Kathy survived that whole thing. She had the big run, had the second big run. Yeah. Seems to have had a third pretty big run here.
I think she's probably made life-changing money for herself through this. And
yeah, I mean, we can throw stones, but I'm sure if we compared bank accounts, she's outdoing all three of us put together. So
facts on facts.
That's a measure of how you want to play the game.
It's an unfortunate reality you bring up, Jake.
So, yeah, my apologies.
It's okay.
I mean, you know, I like it too much. I don't want to blow up. I just want to keep on going. I want to survive. That's my primary setting, which is why I tend to be, you know, short-term bearish, long-term bullish. I think that's the best way to do it. I'm nervous in the short run, but long-term, very, very optimistic. I think got good.
Dude, you see where assets are trading right now. It's kind of hard to be like uber bulled up.
I just mean long-term. I mean, like,
no, long-term. I understand. I get it.
Long-term is not a call on the level of the market. Long-term is a call on the, you know, underlying civilization's ability to generate kind of, you know, technology and quality of life for people into the future. I think it's very good. The pricing of it in the short term is always a little concerning for me. I'd rather get a bit of a discount, you know, for things that aren't having a right. For the birds that I don't have in the hand, I want a bit of a discount.
Yeah. I might kind of start to flex towards long-term idiocracy as a base case, but I don't know. I don't disagree. I'm not just talking about equity markets. I'm talking about like assets generally. Although, you know, my dad watches cars, and apparently the middle of that market that was strong has really started to fall off, and the high-end stuff is still hanging in there, but that's about what you'd expect, I think, towards the beginning of the end of one of those cycles.
It was the hardest thing to tease out is that COVID has just ruined all of the chart, like all of the, it's not just the price charts, it's the underlying fundamentals and all of these things too. So you can't look at anything and like, you got to get what, like pre-2019 now for normalization.
4 year stacks, baby.
What's
awesome. The 4 year stack.
What's that?
Yeah.
Like when you're referring back to 2019, right? There was a 2-year stack and then the 3-year stack. And then it's like, well, we'll go back to 2019. It's a 4-year stack. Yeah. So I can't wait till we have a 10-year stack. It's going to be amazing.
But then
you're not wrong.
The criticism before that was always like, you could, like I used, you know, I like Kate, but the criticism was always, well, 2008 was such an anomaly.
Yeah, I gotta throw
you
that.
Can't use it. Yeah. And now it's like, no, 2000, there's always going to be an anomaly. So maybe you just got to, but I do think that COVID is a real anomaly in that data, like the lumber prices, which we followed for a while.
Still quite a bit higher. I would not call Mike wrong. I mean, I'm not saying that you are. I'm just saying you think about what lumber goes into as an end market is basically directly what the Fed has been attacking as a way to slow down everything. And right now, if you look at the September lumber futures, they're north of 500 per thousand board feet. 500 per thousand board feet 4 years ago was like a high price.
Yeah.
And this is like the market, the end market is basically stopped and it's there. So we shall all find out.
I think as Jake might've said it a few times, but and maybe even Meb Faber said it as well, if someone 12 months ago or 2 years ago gave you the current interest rates and then asked you to guess where the market is, like there's just no way you'd guess it is where it is. You'd say rates up, market down.
Especially since you and I did this in the beginning of the year and Jake reminded us and we were wildly off.
That was embarrassing.
I think it only has to go down 20% for me to be right.
Yeah.
Buckle up.
I think the biggest tell on me is that none of those are internally consistent. Like there's just no way that, it, you know, it's just, I just.
I thought you were hedging your bets by making them nonsensical.
That's what I'm going to claim. It was, that's right. Had the hedge, the portfolio hedge.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense to me.
You know, Greenblatt publishes on his Gotham website, the 2-year look ahead returns for his portfolios, which is an earnings yield built on EBIT EV, which I kind of like because I like that metric. And he says that it's now trading below the 50th percentile. It's like high 40s, 48, 47, something like that, which means that we're in the more expensive part of the half, like still pretty much at the midway point. I kind of have a little bit of trouble getting my head around that, given that for years and years, it's been the other way around.
How does it feel for you when you look at your screens? Does it, and you kind of compare it to historical screens, like what's the general cheapness today of what you do?
I don't track just the yield, although I probably should track that. I'm just less interested in the yield by itself as a number, but I track because I look at rate of reinvestment and expected return and what the historical return, the amount that is being reinvested and the historical return on that reinvestment and the amount that's available. And those numbers are definitely down, you know, as you'd expect. Like October last year was pretty good. And now it's a few percent lower. Like I would say it's the expected returns. And I don't want to make these sound like these are forecasts because they're not.
Like you're going to put up this number, but
I would say
no one in the investment industry would ever say anything like someone would compound 40% from here.
Well, I thought the number was pushing 20 in October, and I would say it's closer to 13.5, 14 now. It just the one that I kind of look at. So it's pretty.
Where do you see
prices running up either?
Well, they have. I mean, they have run up quite a lot from there, from October, like from the October low, they're up quite a lot.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, I agree. Like I look at the Greenblatt stuff, and I'm like, how is that number coming in so much? Because it's not like there's that much performance there.
He's long a bunch of cyclicals.
We talked about it at one point. I mean, it was way up there.
Yeah, but he was long a bunch of cyclicals and the earnings rolled over and the price probably went up a little.
But like, if you think about it, it was the criticism at that point when we were looking at it was, well, it's heavy energy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that energy's come in that much. Like I would say energy's over-earned through that period of time.
No, I think you're coming. I mean, I say for sure. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think, I mean, what if I recall correctly, last quarter, energy earnings were supposed to be down like 47% year over year.
Okay, year over year, really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they freaking printed money. You know what? 2 years ago. Well, not what 12,
2022.
The calendar year of 2022. They destroyed it, right? And they may again. But I bet if they do again, you will see his... I bet you'll see the multiple coming in spot. A little bit. Yeah. So I mean, I'm just looking right now. Top 10 GVLU. Sorry, Jake.
Well, I was just going to say Chevron's down like 7% year to date. Exxon's at roughly flat. Oxy's roughly flat.
Is that earnings or stock price?
This is just stock price. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, his top 10 GVLU, you got Calmain, that's an egg producer. Eggs went through the roof, right? Mueller Industries, Imperial Oil, Marathon Petroleum, Tegna Builders, First Source, Valero CF, and Phillips 66. I mean, it's a lot of cyclicals.
What's GBLU? Is that the Gotham?
Yeah, I think it's his 1,000.
Okay.
Yeah, the 1,000 value.
Because he's got a few funds in there that are like half SPY equivalent, half...
Right. They're rebating of the SPY, basically. Like if you need to hug an index, but you want a little bit of a value tilt, that's like that does.
Yeah. Which seems to me it solves tracking error for him more than it solves any kind of real investment problem for anybody out there.
Yeah, unless you can't actually, I actually think like solving tracking error, I mean, it takes a lot to have substantially different returns from the people around you. That is not the easiest thing. Even if you think you can sense it. Yeah. Same. But yeah, no, I don't know how many people are built for too much tracking error.
Amen.
I mean, none of us are really. We just hope reigns supreme.
Yeah, you always hope, you know. I mean, it's like when you're signing up for an investment product, you're like, yeah, I'm good with tracking error, and then you live through it for 3 or 4 years and you're like, man, that's kind of sucks.
It's a long time.
Yeah
I think that's why Matthew McConaughey meme from True Detective or what one was
the start and the finish. That's right.
Yeah,
the I saw hedge fund concentration in the Magnificent Seven. It's like all-time highs, as you expect, maybe. But that could just be buying and holding, could it? What do you think people are chasing that?
I don't know. Well,
Ted Seides had a pretty good article about that maybe 2 weeks ago or so. And he was saying, and you can feel free to disagree with this if you want, but he was saying that really the only question that matters right now for any kind of allocator and fund is, how much of the Magnificent Seven do you want to have exposure to today? And if it's, you can choose to pick a lot of it and then keep up maybe with everyone else, or maybe you keep down with everyone else. I don't know what the answer to that is, but, or do you want to go different from that? And you're going to then look different for better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer is you want to keep up or keep down with everybody else if you like your job. Which is an unfortunate answer, but that's how I think the world works.
I mean, it's the same problem that we've had for the last few years, that really they are like, they're spectacular businesses too. Like there are solid fundamental reasons for owning them at the same time as there are other, you know, not fundamental reasons for owning them. You could make a pretty good argument that it's a pretty good portfolio. That's Google and Microsoft and Amazon, Meta and whatever else is in there, Netflix, whatever.
Yeah. Tight entry fee cash flow yields, especially, but you know, they're growing and they got good returns. So
yeah, that's right.
It can work.
They're reasonably certain cash flows though, I would have thought. Don't see.
Yeah.
Microsoft getting headed for its, Google's not going to get headed. I mean, you know, long enough period of time, everything's vulnerable, but the next short period of time, none of them.
I read in the Wall Street Journal, and I do not like this idea, but I read that Tencent's at 17 times earnings and Alibaba's at 10. I mean, I'm not sure that I still think that that's an investment necessarily, but it could be an intelligent speculation.
Yeah, that's it. I think that too. They probably are going to work out over a long period of time, unless we get into a cold war, hot war. they decide to chop.
I think that's reasonably probable.
Yeah, like that's the. But that's the. Like everybody's a fundamental investor, and then you just run into some real macro geopolitical macro risk.
Yeah, but that's why they trade where they trade. So is it priced in? We had this with Russia.
Yeah.
It was until it wasn't. I kind of think media is a little bit interesting here as a sector. You should. I hear Tiso's coming on next week. You should talk to him about that. He's got some thoughts.
Yeah, Tiso. I had to process that a little bit. No. Science. Yeah, Alex Morris is coming.
Yeah.
Is he Tiso now?
That's just what I call him for short. You know, TSOH, the science of hitting. I call him Tiso.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I don't know. We're at an interesting point. I've been negative for a very long time, but like now everybody's starting to, push price and start to find out what stuff's worth. And then I don't know. I kind of think like this strike in a one hand kind of sucks, but boy, if you wanted to have a capital cycle theory and some sort of like catalyst to rein in spending somehow, having a strike is a pretty good excuse to really look at the budgets going forward.
What about Disney getting punished the way it has been? Like Disney's like now zero total return for 10 years or zero index return for zero price return for 10 years. And like, that's still it's a beast business. It's just they've stepped on about four landmines as they've released the last four movies.
Yeah. I don't know that it's the movies as much as like you've got it. The investment of the media business is very uncertain right now. And I think you've got to trust that they're going to be able to monetize. I mean, look, I think Marvel's heyday is past it for the foreseeable future. I think they've like Guardians is a fantastic.
That one pretty hard.
Yeah, but like, dude, you're not going to recreate.
Star Wars,
like,
milk that pretty hard.
Yeah, but Star Wars is turning. Like, have you watched Andor?
I watched the first episode, but I've watched so many. I can't do that.
I'm just telling you, well, that's fine. And that's fair. I think that there's a legitimate question to be asked whether or not like media just re-churning all these franchises gets boring in people's minds. I think that could happen.
I'm bored. I'm tired of it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
But then again, I may not be the consumer. Like they might be aiming for 7-year-old kids. That's why I think Disney.
I have the mind of a 7-year-old.
Just not wrong. Andor is probably too.
Got something else of a 7-year-old anyway.
Too grown up for them.
Andor was fantastic, and so The Mandalorian's pretty good, man. And if you start getting those spin-off shows that are like not gimmicky spin-offs, it really unlocks a lot of possibilities for you. And I think Star Wars they may be fixing, and like Guardians was excellent. I'm such a homer. I liked Ant-Man, but I was on a plane, so you gotta kind of forgive that.
Why does that make you a homer?
Well, Ant-Man, a lot of people didn't like it, but I kind of liked it for what Ant-Man's supposed to be. Anyway, I don't know. I think the future is a little uncertain, but the parks business is incredible. And I think ESPN's a little bit like milk in that you have to have it. And I think to protect the bundle. And I think there's a chance that they're going to be able to monetize that in the future. You should ask Alex what the parallels between Disney now and Walmart 10 years ago are and let him riff on that. That'll be a good question.
You remember that one, JT?
Yeah.
All right, you guys.
Got it.
But
Just think Disney's just such a, like, to me, Disney has the potential to be one of the best businesses out there because they, like, I think Buffett said it when it's like an oil well that never runs out, just this perpetual royalty machine. And all you got to do is hook a 7-year-old with a princess or whatever the case may be. And then you feed that you got a generation. And then instead, they've produced these four movies where like there's no discernible princess for. So my daughter has passed through that period and doesn't have a Disney princess.
Doesn't like Elsa?
She was just a fraction young for Elsa.
Show her now. Elsa's the shit.
I'm not trying to get her hooked, mate.
Dude, I used to be on a plane with Frozen in my ear. That's a good movie.
Which one?
Straight up, Frozen. Frozen 2. Frozen is legit. Anyway, I think Buffett, when he talks about Paramount, he talks about what a bad business streaming is, and then he finishes with, we'll see what happens. I think what his version of I think the language between we'll see what happens is I have seen many phases of bundling and unbundling. I've seen media come and go. There's usually a time that they figure it out. And I think the capital cycle theory, like, I think he was early, which is what he would say his general error is, if he makes one, is maybe to be a little early. But I think the bet on Paramount is a bet on ultimate rationality. And I think we are way closer to rationality than we have been for the last 24 months.
You want to own the pipes, or do you want to own the, like, if I had a choice between Disney's current bundle and like the Harry Potter universe, like Harry Potter's, she's got the however many movies, all of the books, now the spin-offs with the Grindelwald, it's now the Wizarding World. They've got a giant computer game out there, and they've got that other.
Zaslav will make sure you know they got the game. He loves to talk about that. Harry Potter's legit. I got love for Harry Potter. The thing about Warner Brothers that I still don't love is you're very tied to the bundle, and you're like, your sports rights are NBA, and I don't know.
How much of the IP do they own, and how much is owned by J.K. Rowling? J.K. Rowling's still got it all, hasn't she? She's going to punch
out. Well, I don't
think
so. I would need to look it up, but I think Warner Brothers has a substantial majority, if not all the rights. She may have like the rights to some other stuff, but I think it's a Warner Brothers property. That could be wrong. Yeah. Do your own due diligence, folks.
Always.
Yeah.
JT, do you have veggies or have you?
I do.
Because you're traveling on a...
It's, you know what? You always got to deliver.
Rain, hail, or shine, the mailman. The mailman's here.
So, oh, by the way, tomorrow will be the 93rd birthday for our favorite Nebraskan, Mr. Warren Buffett. So everyone,
that's a good note.
Warren tomorrow on his birthday.
Hang on 1 second. J.K. Rowling retains all the rights to IP, while Warner Brothers Entertainment owns all the production rights to the films. That is perfect, according to the Google machine. If you don't like it, take it up with Google.
All right.
All right. Sorry. So, I'm back.
Vegetables, you know, being in London.
No such thing. I learned that last week.
Yeah. I'm still skeptical.
Really? Really?
Yeah. It's semantics is what's happening.
Yeah.
It's fair.
So I'm not that far from Westminster Abbey at the moment. So, which happens to be the burial place of Charles Darwin, among other things. So we're doing a Charles Darwin inspired veggie segment this week. And he, of course, everybody knows his contribution of the theory of evolution, 1837, along with Alfred Russel Wallace, right? They kind of they published close together. And also everyone knows the story of him going on a voyage to the Galapagos on the HMS Beagle. Yeah, the Beagle, and getting seeing these different finches with their specialized beaks for getting different types of food adapted to their environment, right? But Darwin also had some other intellectual contributions that we might find useful. And I'm not referring to the pros and cons of marriage, which is one of the things that he wrote about in his journal that they've published.
Was he for it or again? Where did he fall?
Well, so it's a little bit interesting. I'll give you some of the pros he had. Companionship in old age, and quote unquote, better than a dog anyhow.
lives longer.
Number two, children. And then the charms of music and female chit chat. That was another thing in the pro column. The con side, he had it would limit his means, and he'd feel a duty to work more. It would pinch his freedom and his travel. Not having to have to go visit relatives, which is he didn't enjoy, and also it'd keep him from buying as many books as he wanted. And then also fatness and idleness. So I'll let you guys.
I tell you what, man, I would disagree with him almost on each side of that list. Almost everything he said. I mean, not everything, but a lot of it. I prefer her family to my own, but I digress.
Well, maybe Darwin wasn't. Well, here's
more
the
family.
Crazy
more
thing
family.
Is that he was visiting his family and her family because they were first cousins.
Yeah. Well, that's a bit tight.
Well, you know, it was a little bit different time.
So the dude who was into genetics married his first cousin?
Yes.
The evolution of the species.
That is interesting. Mm.
All right, so let's get this back.
This is why I'm long-term long Idiocracy, by the way.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
Perhaps his most powerful and maybe least known an insightful contribution, had nothing to do with marriage or evolution, right? It's that whenever Darwin was faced with an alternative hypothesis to his beliefs, with some new information that jarred with what he believed, he would make sure that he wrote it down within 30 minutes of learning about it.
Mm.
And the purpose behind that was that he said he would make a habit of doing this because otherwise his mind would automatically reject that idea. And he'd continue along as if, you know, on his original path, as if he'd never seen it. And basically, this is the inverse of confirmation bias. Like, he's working hard to combat that. So, you know, usually for me, like when it gets triggered, I'll have a feeling of surprise. That's often what that means. Like, and really surprise is when your brain is saying that the incoming data stream from your senses doesn't match this Bayesian model of what it's expecting. That's what surprises. So personally for me, I have a tag in my note-taking where I call it a Darwin fact. You know, it's hashtag Darwin fact. And it's when I come across something that goes against one of my cherished beliefs, and I made it this bright yellow color so it stands out and really jumps off the page at me. And so periodically I'll go back and review my Darwin facts over a period of time, because I can just click on that tag and see it. And I'll think about how it conflicts with these, you know, cherished beliefs that I hold on to. And what I'm trying to do is pull my brain back away from arriving at too firmly at any conclusion. And when there's, especially when there's disconfirming evidence staring me right in the face, right? So I think it's just good thought hygiene in general to point out your Darwin facts for yourself. And that way you don't end up on the confirmation bias superhighway that takes you far from reality.
Have you had a Darwin fact change your mind on anything?
Boy, that's a good question. Nothing jumps to mind at the moment, but it certainly pulls me back from just the certainty, right? Like just dialing back the certainty, even when I'm feeling very, very strongly about something, a Darwin fact will at least stop and make me to re-examine and recalibrate.
This reminds me a little bit of Adam Robinson's concept of looking into things that make no sense to you and things that make a lot of sense. Like I think where it rhymes is like the things that make no sense. It's probably your brain doesn't fully see the world as the world is, right?
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, he had said, he's like, you can make a lot of money in both those scenarios. And I think one is because you actually really understand the scenario, and the other is because you're probably not thinking about it right. And if you can get yourself to that spot, maybe it helps. Maybe you say, this still doesn't make any sense. Like what happened to AAMC, that call, which I liked. I said I liked that pitch a long time ago, but then they turned into an EV car company, and that I do not like. Thankfully, I was not long. The stock went down like 90%.
That's a Darwin fact.
Market didn't like it either. That is a Darwin fact. But like maybe now it's worth looking at, right? I don't know.
Got a question from the audience, Jake. Can you name some on your list that were yellow? Or just give us a flavor of what sort of stuff you made yellow?
This is proprietary IP, folks. Yeah. You got to pay the man for this.
No, not necessarily. Let me look real quick and see where I've got some.
I'll tell you what it is. In 2017, he has in big bold letters, Bill is a schmuck. And then we met each other and he was like, there's a Darwin fact here. He's maybe not as big of a schmuck as I thought.
Some of these are so idiosyncratic. They might not be that interesting for, here's one that kind of popped up. I was researching a company and the fist, like they put year to date and then like July 9th, 2023. What would you imagine that the time period of measurement is when it comes to year to date, July 9th, 2023? What's the dates that's measuring?
It's going to be, I'm guessing that the way that you asked the question is June 30th to July 9th, but you would expect it to be January 1st to July 9th.
I actually thought June 30th, but yeah.
Yes.
It's got to have some weird fiscal end. Has to.
It was a fiscal year to date, but it doesn't say fiscal year to date. And so I caught it and I thought, oh gosh, how many times have I actually made this mistake without realizing that I was adding up what I thought was 9 or 7 months worth of data, but was really a year's worth of data? Like, that's a big difference.
We should outlaw fiscal years that don't end on 12/31. I'll run on that.
You could
that make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You don't get to make your own year. That's not how it works.
But having said that, Australia's June 30 for tax. That throws everything. And then you can pick your own for the public company. It's a, you know, April. I've seen all of them. I've got an April year end.
April, all right. Here's another one I had. This was profit margins going up in my face even further from what I thought that they could ever go. So I put that one in as a, you know, you thought it was going to regress from 13.3 and it went up to like 15.5 in Q2 of 2022.
Yeah, I would think the whole like COVID and all the outcome, like all the economic outcomes would be one huge Darwin effect for me. And I'm not sure, I don't even think we know all of them yet. So we shall find out. But I wouldn't think that we would skate through all that as unscathed as we have.
Total debt outstanding for all S&P 500 constituents was 9.5% below 2007 peak in this was in June of last year. And I would have thought at that point that the total corporate debt was above 2007 levels. That's the kind of stuff that I'm catching myself with.
Anything to do with like the composition, like where financial is a big component of the S&P, like highly levered?
I've got a weird fact that I got this one from Morgan Housel. And I don't know if this is true or not, but Morgan said it, so I haven't verified it myself, but he says that there's less cardboard used today than there was in the 1990s.
Mm. Oh, has he seen anyone's porch?
Well, he said that in the context of knowing that. So he must, I don't know if they make the cardboard boxes a thin, like maybe they're half the thickness, but even then you'd think maybe it's recycled faster. I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that. That's a nice thought. Smart.
Those would be good. Returns. Yeah.
Maybe.
I got to check that one. I shouldn't have said that like that was it. But there's the source. Morgs is the source on that one.
I'm sure he's fine with it.
Yeah.
I'm sure he said it publicly. I'm sure it's come from a tweet. I don't think I got that one from the horse's mouth. I didn't get that one direct. So I've got this very important piece of information I have to tell you.
Here's a Darwin fact, cardboard. And I don't think I'm like talking out of school here because he told us all in a public setting, and I'm sure he's told the story previously. But here's an interesting tidbit of Morgan's history. That book, almost every publisher said no to, despite how well-read the blog post is. I think he was on his last shot with a publisher when they finally said like, yeah, we'll do it. And look at what a success that was. That's and good crazy. For him for sticking with it. Yeah.
He's got a almost no one wanted to he's have got a it. Huge built-in audience.
I know. And he was like, look at how many people have read this blog post. Like I can do a book on this. And people are like, no, we don't like it.
Well, Harriman's a good publisher. So he did well there.
Fair play to you.
Yeah.
It's good for Harriman too. That's their big winner to those guys there. Happy for them both.
That was a financial Harry Potter.
I want to compliment right. you on a serious pro move. Last week, when you were asking Corey about an ETF that he may or may not have currently registered, you are a pro.
Who asked about it? Me.
Yeah, it was a fantastic question that you asked.
Leading objection.
Yeah. Yeah, this is amazing.
I'll have to go back and watch the tape on that one. Do it again.
A pro's pro, man.
It was a monkey typewriter question. It just the words came out in the right order.
Nah.
You say enough words, those things will happen. Ask enough questions, those things will happen.
Nah, you knew what you were doing. It was strong.
What's the market look like to you guys? How are you feeling just generally?
70-30
around. Yeah, that's fair. Is that a setting? Is that an age setting, or that's your comfort setting?
I don't know. It's probably somewhat where I am at life, and I'm just not you know, I think your gross numbers relative to your spend matter a lot. So like, I don't think that you can just take a formula and apply it, but I think it gives me enough where if I were to take the 20% of in a hyper aggressive scenario, I could change my life for the better. And if that never happens and the 70 grows, my life should be better over time as long as I can manage my spending. And it's just it's a comfort that I can deal with. Money? Yeah, but I wouldn't spend it on NetJets, man. That shit's wasteful.
Go straight to the G6.
No, it's too. It's not good for the environment. It costs too much money. I actually strongly disagree that flying. Well,
G6 not good for the environment. Write that down.
If I actually did something,
you're not
going to
get invited to Davos with that kind of attitude, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'd never fly coach again ever. Like, don't get me wrong, but I'm not. I don't need to fly private.
You're not going to own the G6. You're going to get the NetJet subscription.
No, I it's like $7,000 an hour, man. It's disgusting to me. That money can go to much better causes. Send kids to school for that kind of money. Like that, I don't need that shit. I'm no saint with money. I'm not trying to say that.
At the same time as the front of the plane, Billy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would pay for all the upgrades for all the travel and all the airports. Okay, I might have my own entrance. Like, I'm not saying that I wouldn't be flying coach with y'all, but I wouldn't be on NetJets.
It's like a stoic exercise. You know, that's what Munger would be flying. He'd fly coach even when he was really wealthy because he just wanted to stay in touch with the common man, you know?
That's like Vipassana meditation. You got to fold your body into those seats and be in pain for 6 hours on the way to New York, and then you get there enlightened. And
Mark Leonard says he does that.
I think he said he pays for it himself. There's no way that man is flying coach. He's 6'7" and he's got to be 250-ish. Probably that's being generous. It's just I'm not nearly that size, and I get my knees right up against the back of the seat.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with that. Up being super tall, so I just get in my little seat, and read my book,
swing your legs.
Yeah, like a little kid, just.
Oh, that was funny. Anyway.
Yeah, Mark used to fly coach. He stopped. Thank you, Hive Mind.
All right, who's got questions?
We're like 6% from all-time highs, 6.8% from all-time highs. Who wants to take a bet on whether we get there or not? Throw your bids in the comments too so we can find someone. When do we get to all-time highs? If you say we don't get there, give us a reason why. I mean, obviously, we're getting to all-time highs at some point again in the future. I mean, in this current run-up, it seems inevitable from this point. Like 6.6% is nothing.
I don't know, man. I mean, I am conflicting opinions on this. On one hand, I think you're right. And on the other, like, you and I, and I know Jake kind of agrees with this. I don't know that he articulates his bearish market thoughts quite as much as we do, but I do think like it would just be beautiful from an observation standpoint to like touch the highs and then just destroy everybody. Like I just think like that would be poetic, right? So
at them like Max Payne.
Move. Yeah. Yeah, like you got to get everybody to be like, shit, I should have been long, and then just rip their soul out.
Do you think when it gets over that, like the people who fly the 200-day, like when it goes over the 200-day, everybody's like, yeah, it's all get back in the water, boys. It's safe to swim.
Yeah, or some sort of 50-20 or 200 crossover, right? Some sort of momentum
indicator. Golden cross.
Yeah.
You know what? We haven't heard death cross for a little while.
No, that's right.
The death cross is the reverse.
Hindenburg omen. Is that still a thing?
What that was?
No,
I can never figure out what that is. It's a,
I don't remember.
There's
what it is.
Like 13 things have to happen for the Hindenburg omen.
Seems to be a lot of stuff out there that's still cheap, though. I don't know. I guess my strongest opinion is if you're fishing in a pond from one to call it $8 billion, there's probably some good values out there, and I think they'll probably outperform the index. But I don't know what the index is going to do.
My strongest opinion is that if the business makes sense to you and you think you're getting a good deal on it, go go ahead and buy it and suffer with equanimity if the price moves again. Damn it, we missed you, Bill.
The soundboard works.
It finally works.
Yes. Well, way to jump in with the right answer, Jake. Thanks.
Sorry.
Yeah, that is technically correct, which is the best kind of correct.
Doesn't get good ratings, though.
It does not.
This so is why we never had Twizzler money. Thank you, Jake.
Let me read a few. There's a few good comments here. Ron Zola says nominal highs in an inflationary period are expected. Talk in real terms. I agree, but you know what are we going to use as the deflator? I guess we can use CPI as a deflator.
Yeah. Cumulative, what, 14% or something over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, how are you, mate? Like, something like 80% of all the money outstanding was printed in the last few years. Like, that's going to...
I am willing to admit that it doesn't feel transitory when I go buy eggs.
I can see it in my Mint account. The spending in my Mint account is like... I've adopted another child or something. It's like
a red little leaf now instead of green.
I've got this extra member of the family, like, or I've doubled the size of my family. There's a lot of spending in there.
Name him Jerome.
Well, I think, yeah, that's right. I think Jerome is doing the best that he can with what he's got. I like what he's doing for the most part. I think he's kind of getting there as long as he keeps on cranking it.
He's only, yeah, I mean, he's got two mandates, right? So the guy's got to do, he's got to do one until the other breaks.
They've also got climate change in there now, too. Yeah. You've got full employment, price stability, climate change.
I mean, the thing that I think should keep everybody up at night is inflation came down in a period where oil came down. What if we get inflation that rips again? And then, like, where do rates have to go? And then what does the world look like? I think that's like the scary scenario. Well, and I know that I'm 3 years late on this thought and whatever, but I'm just saying, like, I don't think people are still thinking inflation being the real risk.
And I don't think they might have been thinking that in 1975. And they thought, the worst of it was behind us. We're on the other side of the, it was transitory. And then,
We're going to see that just now because the peak in terms of the rate of change was June last year. And so we've been seeing the year-on-year figures have been coming down, but we've got rid of that base effect. And so now we're going to see for the next few months and quarters, the base effect is going to go back up again. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, trueflation is down, but like my food and my gas ain't.
It just means that the rate of, like, it's no longer going up. Like, it's not going back. The prices aren't going down. Yeah. They're just going to stay where they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if your income is flat year on year and your costs have gone up 40%, then in real terms, there's a lot left over at the end of the month. There's a lot less left over at the end of the month.
Better than owning debt, though, I guess, because the debt spends a lot worse, too.
Exactly. Can't buy as many hamburgers when you get your principal back.
Took the kids to the Federal Reserve of Chicago, indoctrinated them with the man. Frolics.
Yeah.
No, I did not.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. I'm joking.
It's actually a pretty fun little museum that you can see $1 million in ones, twenties, and hundreds. And it's kind of cool to see like the difference in the volume of the cubes. Blew the kids' minds. And then they give out shredded money. And my oldest, he's like, can we put this together? I'm like, no, dude, that's not going to work. I love the thought. Not going to work.
Yeah, there you go, hustler.
Yeah.
Shredded money's fun.
Yeah.
There was an Australian stock market promoter kind of, you know, takeover guy. He said he shredded his first million.
Mm. That's gangster.
How is it true that you stuffed it into the
Stay pillow? Hungry. The Stay hungry. Keep hustling.
Yeah, I might deposit it and then shred the bank statement.
Yeah, take it as a check and then just frame it.
Yeah, that's right.
After you deposit it.
Yeah,
that's right. All right, fellas, we made it. That's full time. Thanks, everybody.
Nice seeing you guys.
Love you, Billy.
Yeah, love you guys too. Love the listeners, except the ones that don't love me. But I still got love for you.